Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Most people don't know how many financial accounts they have or their net worth. And when you're not paying attention, you're leaving money on the table. The solution is Monarch, an all-in-one personal finance tool that brings your entire financial life together in one clean interface on your laptop or phone. In just minutes, link all your accounts for a complete picture of your financial health. You'll never need a spreadsheet again. Get 50% off your first year. That's just $50 total at monarch.com with code BUDGET. That's monarch.com, promo code BUDGET.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by audible.co.uk. Download one title each month, plus unlimited listening to thousands of Audible originals, podcasts, and audiobooks. Just click on the Audible banner at www.tre.radio.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. As always, we start by looking at the bestseller lists on Amazon.co.uk and the Sunday Times, the oldest and most influential book sales chart in the UK. Not many new entries this week. Then we're catching up with Ed Needham, the editor of Strong Words magazine. He joins us monthly to review a selection of new fiction and non-fiction titles, which this week includes a biography about the Sopranos actor James Gandolfini. Emma Cowell is back with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel set in Greece, Under the Lemon Tree. It's set on the breathtaking island of Agistri. And we're chatting to Stephanie Nunes, a brilliant Brazilian writer who now lives in London. Falling on a Duke is a swoon-worthy, time-travelling contemporary romance about a duke lost in time and a writer lost in heartbreak. That's just the first hour. In the second hour, we're chatting to Jeffrey Deaver, C.R. Westbrook, and Ben Markowitz.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
The pen's in my hand, ending unplanned. Staring at the blank page before you, open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you.
Good evening. Welcome to The Book Show. We start by looking at the Sunday Times bestseller list, the oldest and most influential book sales chart in the UK and the one that every author wants to be on. So this chart is the most accurate and comprehensive estimation of book sales in the country. Stephen King returns to familiar territory, the number one spot in the fiction hardbacks chart, that is. Never Flinch is the American horror writer's 32nd book to score a Sunday Times number one. And as a film adaptation of The Salt Path, starring Gillian Anderson, comes to UK cinemas, the original memoir by Rayna Wynn returns to the bestseller charts. The book has now spent over 2 years in the top 10. Starting with general hardbacks, there are just two new entries from last week. At number one, Big Dunk by Duncan Ferguson. Number two, The Let Them Theory by Mel Robbins. Number three is one of the new entries called Always Winning by Ashley Walters and Chris Asai. Hard-earned wisdom and stories from the Peckham-born actor and musician. Number four is Ocean by David Attenborough and Colin Butfield. Number five, Sword by Max Hastings. Number six is A River Alive by Robert McFarlane. Number seven, The Buried City by Gabrielle Zuchtriegel. Number eight is the other new entry, SAS Great Escapes 4 by Damian Lewis. More stories of Second World War escapes carried out by the Special Forces Unit. Number nine is Tina by Niall Harbison. And number 10, Original Sin by Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson. Looking at fiction hardbacks, again, just two new entries from last week. At number one, as I mentioned, is Never Flinch by Stephen King. P.I. Holly Gibney faces a killer's cryptic threat and a client with a stalker. Number two is By Your Side by Ruth Jones. Number three, The Devils by Joe Abercrombie. Number four is Nightshade by Michael Connolly. Number five, Onyx Storm by Rebecca Yarros. Number six, This House of Burning Bones by Stuart McBride. Number seven, The Night and the Moth by Rachel Gillig. Number eight is the other new entry called A Fate Forged in Fire by Hazel McBride. A blacksmith with fire magic seeks to overthrow a corrupt monarchy. Number nine is Tyrant by Con Iggulden. And number 10, Quicksilver by Callie Hart. Moving on to Amazon.co.uk, still at number one, The Housemaid by Frieda McFadden, which is excellent. Number two, The Salt Path by Raina Wynne. Number three, Cozy Corner, a calm and comforting colouring book for all ages by Coco Wayo. Number four, The Housemaid's Secret by Frieda McFadden, which I'm about halfway through now, really good. Number five, Big Dunk by Duncan Ferguson. Number six, The Let Them Theory by Mel Robbins. Number seven, Sunrise on the Reaping by Suzanne Collins. Number eight, Cozy Cuties, a cute and comfy colouring book for all ages by Coco Wayo. Number nine, We Solve Murders by Richard Osman. And number 10, The Tenant by Frieda McFadden.
You're listening to The Book Club on Talk Radio Europe. And keep listening. That's an instruction from Margaret Thatcher.
Joining us on the line now is Ed Needham. He's the editor and publisher of Strong Words magazine. He joins us every month with some new book reviews. How are you, Ed?
I'm very well, thanks. Yes.
Good. Good, good. So let's start with fiction. You have chosen Fun and Games.
Yes, Fun and Games by John Patrick McHugh. He's a young Irish author. This is his first novel, and he is a writer very much beloved by Sally Rooney. And in the world of book blurbs, you know, an endorsement by Sally Rooney is about as powerful a buy this book message as you could ask for. So he's got off to a good start. It's based around the rather sort of humdrum or at least unremarkable life of a 17-year-old boy called John in the west of Ireland, in rural County Mayo. And he's in his last year of school before going off to college. He lives with his mother because his parents have recently separated, and he plays Gaelic football. And he's just been promoted to the senior side, where he's wondering if he's going to be picked for the team. He knows it doesn't quite fit in with the older players. But anyway, these are, you know, all these events in his life are, they're kind of unremarkable. And the texture of his life is described in quite precise detail. Even the sort of small sort of unremarkable events get very, you know, no aspect is too plain or ordinary to avoid description. But there's one outstanding aspect of life as a 17-year-old that he just cannot get his head around, and that is girls and sex and his complete inability to sort of process the business of intimacy with girls in a very, you know, in a very normal way. And I think that's what makes this book kind of so special, is its ability to write about this this tremendous sort of it's not even awkwardness, but sort of double double-sided thing. So let me see if I can explain that a bit. So he, when he's in the business of having girlfriends, being intimate with girls, he finds himself tremendously awkward. And it's something he's constantly apologising for. So for John, any close encounter with a girl is something that just means having to say sorry over and over and over again to her, and this sort of overwhelming sense of self-consciousness. But even worse, it means having to provide a rather inaccurate and rather sort of ungallant relationship history to his friends. So he has to present a sort of masculine and very, very knowing and sort of knowledgeable version of himself too. So it's a picture of this kid who on one hand is just about to leave childhood, but on the other hand, he's absolutely not about to enter adulthood. He's much too sort of innocent and raw. So part of the book is asking what is this phase? It's not so much a coming of age as a stumbling forward. And then the other part is this version of maturity, the fact that you have to somehow negotiate the reality of being intimate with other people, while also at the same time presenting what you feel is the right image to show other people, especially your male friends, and create the right impression with your peers. And that just involves no end of inaccuracy, you know, and as I mentioned, awkwardness, and ultimately kind of dismal relationships with the girls that you're trying to make progress with. So it's called Fun and Games, lots of games, less fun. And it's by John Patrick McHugh.
Oh, I bet a lot of young lads go through that. I'm sure there'll be readers that can relate.
Oh, I think it's going to be sort of universal, yes, in its degree of recognition. You know, that in the midst of this really rather sort of unremarkable process of growing up, is this absolute chaos of having to sort of behave one way and yet present this impression of yourself that really doesn't correspond with your experience of it at all.
Yeah.
So, yes, I think it's very good.
Then we have Fair Play.
Yes, Fair Play by Louise Hegarty. This is another debut by another Irish writer, and this is a sort of a play on the sort of classic locked room puzzle mystery, the kind of novel that was so beloved of golden age crime writers such as that Agatha Christie. So it's New Year's Eve 2022, and a group of friends have gathered. This is something they do every year, and they've gathered to stage a murder mystery evening. This is how they see in the new year. And the following day, New Year's Day, is also going to be the birthday of one of them. So it's a kind of joint New Year's birthday shindig, and they dress up. They, you know, they go full out for this kind of thing. They've rented a country house for a few days. They dress up. This year's theme is the Jazz Age detective, so very Agatha Christie. They're given cards explaining, you know, who they are in this drama, what role they have to play, and a number of details about their characters and relationships to other people, this kind of thing. And they all get stuck into the champagne to really make it go with a bit more of a swing. So there aren't really quite enough of them to sort of stretch it out. But any, you know, so kind of anyone, anyone could have done it. There just aren't enough characters kind of in the thing, but they reach a conclusion. It's slightly unimpressive, could have been anyone who did it. And then they just get on with the drinking and arguing a bit, sharing a few intimate details with each other, seeing in the new year. One of them ends up so drunk he sleeps on the sofa. But then the following morning, one of them really is dead and behind a locked door. So at this point, the book kind of splits, and on one path, it becomes a novel very much in the style of an Agatha Christie, a classic Christie. A Poirot-style detective arrives, famous and brilliant, and he starts interrogating the other people in the house. And it feels as though the case has somehow been transported back to the 20s or 30s, but with a couple of exceptions. So the detective appears to know that he is in a book. He keeps making references to, you know, in chapter 18, I will do this, or he seems to have this sort of level of awareness that he is actually a character in a novel. And the other thing is that there are these modern day references. These anachronisms really sort of stand out. So somebody mentions they've got a particular hair product or a duvet, things that you just wouldn't find in an Agatha Christie novel. So it leaves you very much, you know, not at all sure about what is going on. So that's one path. And then the other path is very much the modern day aftermath, you know, in the last couple of years, of the death of this character. So the funeral, the forensic verdict, the adaptation of people's lives to this person having died. So there's a case to solve, and you are very much, you know, looking for clues. You know, everybody has read Agatha Christie and other books, you know, from that period. So you're looking for clues in that style, explanations, trying to piece it together. But at the same time, you also have to try and work out what is going on with these parallel accounts of events that never seem to intersect or share information. So it's a very sort of clever version of the an Agatha Christie novel. It's called Fair Play, and it's by Louise Hegarty.
Interesting, the way it's written and laid out. Very unusual.
I mean, Agatha Christie, the magic of Agatha Christie never fades. It's extraordinary how people just keep coming back to her. There is something about that genre of novel and the way she did it, just the piecing together of clues and puzzles, that people just can't get enough of it. And I don't, you know, there's so many weaknesses in Agatha Christie. The fact that, she never seems to, no characters ever really respond to anyone having died. You know, they just go about their business as if it's the most normal thing. There's no sort of emotional reaction. It doesn't change people's lives in unexpected directions. There are all these just completely implausible things, yet there is something about the Christie puzzle mystery that engrosses people to the extent that they can't help but apply it to normal life when sometimes, you know, perhaps it doesn't fit. So, you know, I feel that it's one of the kind of book that is just going to keep coming back and back. People are constantly going to be referring to Agatha Christie in different ways, as they have done for many years now.
And finally, for fiction, Running the Light by Sam Tallant. I have him on the book show in a few weeks' time.
Oh, good for you. Yes, I spoke to myself for strong words, and he's a very engaging chap. He's an American comedian, Sam Tallant. His novel is called Running the Light, and he has been, I think he's been on the comedy circuit for quite a long time now. He studied when he was 18, so quite young. I think he's in his late 30s perhaps now, so he's been at it for at least 20 years. But this is another debut novel, and it's a novel about a week in the life of an American road comedian. So this character once was something. He used to be on television, was building a bit of a national reputation, but something happened to him, and he's now stuck on this circuit, having to drive from one town to another to perform in lousy clubs and at grotty sort of men's stag do's just to make a few hundred dollars to keep petrol in his car and to just about keep his head above water. So he's called Billy Ray Schaefer, and he drives from one town to another in the American Southwest, New Mexico, Colorado, small towns in these states, and he is an absolute mess. You know, he's dissolute, drinks a lot, takes too many drugs, gets robbed, disastrous one-night stands. You know, he is almost on a sort of self-destruct autopilot. But as a comedian, he is sort of sufficiently hardened that he's able to get up on stage in front of a crowd of people who are often not particularly pleased to see him. You know, they may be patrons of a bar who are watching a football game on TV, and the TV has just been turned off to let this stranger get up on stage and start insulting them and their town. So it's not an easy life. But anyway, he knows how to perform. He collects his money. He can more or less drive himself to the next venue. But absolutely everything else is a mess of a calamitous nature. You know, it's amazing that he's still alive. So the book in part gives you the backstory of how things came to this. His life hasn't always been lurching from one hangover to the next. And in part, it leaves you thinking, well, this can't go on. So what's going to happen to change his trajectory? And it's a novel, you tend to think that has to be some sort of act of redemption. But as he stumbles from one venue to the next, it gets harder and harder to see where that might come from. And then the other really strong point is the way in which the author sustains this vision of a really rather unappetizing and difficult life. You know, you might think of comedians as being quite sort of thoughtful, educated, perhaps energetic, sociable, but whenever showbiz is involved, you only need to sort of look round the back for a moment to witness an entirely different dynamic at work. So that's called Running the Light, and it's by Sam Tallant.
Sounds good. And on to non-fiction, Cellar Rat.
Okay, so I've chosen a couple of books about restaurants, and both these books happen to be about restaurants in New York. And I'm a bit of a fan about anything to do with restaurants. I really like food, but there's something about restaurants which is kind of, they're kind of, you know, as a place to read about, they're kind of too much. You know, there's too much pressure, too much heat, all those people working in dangerous proximity, sharp knives and hot things. There's the challenge of making money and keeping a restaurant, making ends meet, building one's reputation. And so the restaurant industry tends to demand really special people. You know, you have to be special to put up all that pressure, sadistic chefs shouting at you, and a very different sort of social life. You know, when your friends are out in the evening, you're at work, and when they're at work, you're not. So you tend to hang out with just restaurant people. And so this first book, Cellar Rat by Hannah Selinger, it's the account of a woman from New England who after college and bit of time sort of working in a bar in her hometown, she decides that life is passing her by. So she moves to New York to try and make things happen as a writer. And in the meantime, she starts working in restaurants, first as a waiter, and then after a time as a sommelier, and the restaurant work kind of takes over. So this book is fantastic on the pressures and the hierarchy of a kitchen. And it being New York, there are some truly awful people. There's one celebrity pastry chef who's some sort of idiot with a massive social following who believes he's a total rock star. And she has a thing with him in which he just shows himself to be an absolute, you know, you can add your favorite insult here, but he is nowhere near as cool as he'd like to think he is. And there's a chef who is just given to these explosions of abuse when the restaurant gets busy. And went to one person, he says, "I will murder your family." You know, that's not what you want to hear.
Oh, my goodness.
Trying to get on with your work.
We thought Gordon Ramsay was bad.
So we're quite familiar with this chef stereotype, but it's always pleasing to be shown more evidence. But what you get here is also the demands of actually being a waiter at a high-end restaurant, which is something perhaps you never really see. So it's quite impressive when you get to see, they have to not only do they have to remember all the specials, but you have to remember where everyone is sitting, which customer has ordered what. You have to remember what the women have ordered, so they're served their food first, and the wine has to be poured in a particular order, and there's such a long list of what you can and can't do. So on top of putting up with the pressures of the kitchen and the pressures of the business and the pressures of some less than charming customers too, there's all this stuff that you have to remember. And so she quite enjoys the sort of slightly addictive nature of this work, and surviving all this drama produces a bit of a high and a sense of camaraderie. But ultimately, you know, she decides she is not a cheerleader for the industry at all. This is an industry with a lot of problems, and it's very bad for your health. So that's called Cellar Rat, and it's by Hannah Selinger.
Oh, I love the sound of that, but it makes me nervous that it'll put me off going to nice restaurants.
I don't think you have to worry as a customer so much.
Okay.
This is, so long as, it's the behind the scenes where the nastiness.
Yeah, okay,
it's
fair
a bit
enough.
Overwhelming.
Then we have I Regret Almost Everything.
Yes, by Keith McNally. And Keith McNally is one of the great names in the New York restaurant scene. So he's from the East End of London, and he doesn't have a particularly fond sort of reminiscence of his childhood at home. He decided not to follow his father into working on the docks, and he tried to become an actor as a teenager. The big sort of scoop of this book is that he was for many years the lover of the playwright Alan Bennett. In the late 60s, he went on the hippie trail, sort of Kashmir and the likes. And in the early 70s, he decided he was going to give New York a go. And he started working in bars and restaurants, had this very sort of immersive education, learned a lot about what makes people come back or stay away, how restaurants tick. And he set up his own restaurant, a restaurant called Odeon, which is still there downtown, right at the foot of where the World Trade Center used to be, in a neighborhood that was then, you know, sort of way off the beaten track. But he obviously had a real gift for it. And Odeon was a huge hit, popular with celebrities. And he went on to open many other hit new restaurants in New York. So he talks a great deal about how they came about, which is interesting, and his ideas as to what makes them successful. So he's not at all interested in fine dining, you know, fiddling around with little flowers on dishes with tweezers and all this kind of stuff. His theories as to what makes a restaurant successful are a little unusual. One of his beliefs is that you have to have really small tables so that people are kind of forced into proximity with their dining companions and have to interact with them. And another is that he describes himself as a renovator by trade. He's not a cook. He's not a gourmet. For him, the appeal is creating the right environment and finding the bits and pieces, often from just a tiny scrap of an idea and putting it all together. So in a way, the magic happens long before the restaurant opens. So he had hit after hit. He could do no wrong. And this in an industry, in a city that, you know, that traditionally drives people mad. No one can tell what is going to work. And to have a long string of restaurant hits implies real magic. But then, as we also know from early in the book, things take quite an unfortunate turn. So he's successful, busy, highly motivated, curious, really living a life. But he then suffers a very disabling stroke, and it paralyzes part of his body, and it causes him to suddenly see his life from a very different perspective. So we get also, you know, the details of his marriage breaking down, his relationship with his children becomes quite conflictive, and his exasperation at just not being able to do the things that he used to do and move around as he used to. And then worst of all, he seems to have lost his touch in the restaurant business. So it's a great book. He has this hugely successful life, and this is a truly raw and honest record of how even the most gilded lives can sometimes take, you know, the most unexpected turns that lead to these sort of drawbacks and downturns, and suddenly things seem very different. Wow. So that's I Regret Almost Everything by Keith McNally.
And finally, Gandolfini by Jason Bailey.
Yes, Gandolfini is obviously about the great and no longer with us James Gandolfini, the actor who played Tony Soprano. And even though this has to, you know, have playing a character like that has to be just about most actors' dream, you know, to breathe life into a character who enters into the culture on so many levels, and to be this, you know, to play this hardened killer who people had genuine affection for is an extraordinary achievement. But by the end of his run on the show, the pressures were becoming unbearable. The fans, the demands of the role, he fell out with the show's creator. He would disappear on these sort of lost weekends of drink and drugs. The crew never were sure if he would be there on set from one day to the next. But it's not a muckraking biography. This is the kind of biography that recognises he had these demons, but doesn't dive into them as though it's the biographer's prime duty to expose every sort of humiliating misstep in a celebrity career. So instead it focuses a lot on the acting. And James Gandolfini was an actor who took acting very seriously. He was constantly obsessed over how to get into character, fanatical about what it took to bring a character to life. And he started acting quite early, straight out of college. And if you like to sort of biographies that show people in a favourable light, James Gandolfini was a genuinely good person. You know, he was really considerate to his castmates, so considerate that he shared his pay rise with them. You know, he was truly kind, very giving, very popular and modest. So in a way, even though it really gets into the scale of playing the character as gigantic as Tony Soprano, it also presents this image of a very kind and modest man. So it's perhaps not the picture we tend to see of celebrities at all.
Oh, nice. Well, some great books this month. Thank you very much, Ed Needham, editor and publisher of Strong Words magazine. If people want to read some of the interviews that you do with a lot of these authors or get some great book recommendations, they should definitely check out Strong Words magazine. How do you suggest they do that?
Yes, they absolutely definitely should check out Strong Words magazine, and also the weekly newsletter that I put out, which is called the Strong Words Sunday Book Club, which has more great books, more recommendations. And you can find information about how to sign up to both on the Strong Words website, which is strong-words. Don't forget the hyphen, strong-words.co.uk.
Perfect. Ed, thank you so much. Have a great month.
Likewise, you're more than welcome.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Emma Cowell, a former actress and BBC presenter. Segueing from being paid to talk for a living into writing was a natural progression, since storytelling has been at the heart of her career to date. She's back with us on The Book Show to talk about her latest novel set in Greece, Under the Lemon Tree. Welcome to The Book Show, Emma.
Thank you so much for having me back. It's an absolute treat to speak to you again.
Oh, it's lovely to have you back with us. How have you been and how much time have you spent in Greece? Make me jealous.
Never enough. I'm planning my next trip and counting down the days, but Greece always calls to me. And it's always the thing when I'm writing my book that's going to be out in 2026. And when I'm in the UK, although I'm very lucky to live in Cornwall and the weather has been amazing, writing about Greece just makes me hanker to have that sort of Grecian experience, to smell the wild herbs on the wind and stick my feet in the water and stuff my face in a taverna.
Do you manage to get there every year?
I do, yes. I really carve out blocks of time. When I'm at a real crunch point in a book or doing major edits, I try to take some time off the day job and just immerse myself in Greece and my writing. So it's not to say the writing comes easier being out there, but it certainly flows better when you're looking at or tasting the things you're writing about every day in an authentic way.
Yeah. And do you like to explore different parts of Greece each time you go, or do you have favourite places that you go back to?
I have some favourites, but I do go to different corners because every book I write is standalone. So I want to set those in different places and also to bring a corner of Greece for a reader that they maybe have never been to or never heard of. So Under the Lemon Tree is set on an island called Agistri, which is about 40 minutes on the boat from Athens. But the previous books, The Island Love Song, was on an island called Idra or Hydra. And then I was on the mainland for the first two in Methone and Petalidi. So I've got thoughts and plans about book six. I know where that's going to be set. And book seven and beyond, it'll be a new corner each time.
Oh, I love that. And I mean, I'm a huge lover of Greece. I haven't been there for far too long, but always, always desperate to go back. Spent three summers there working in Naxos. Might you set a book there?
It's entirely possible. It really is. I was actually on my way back from the airport. My husband's just collected me and we were chatting about different places. I had a message from a bookshop in Lefkada, which is a big island just above Kefalonia. And they stock my books and have been very supportive, saying, come for a coffee in our courtyard. We'd love to meet you. And I was like, well, you know, if I'm going to go somewhere for a coffee in a courtyard in a bookshop, my brain starts to think, Lefkada, maybe there's a book there. There is a book at every turn in Greece. Everywhere I go, Hannah, I become so immersed in local life, in the culture and the food. And I just watch people go about their lives and start to imagine where they're off to, who have they been to see? And then it starts to take shape, really.
Yeah. And like any country, I suppose, do you always marvel at each time you visit different places, how much they can differ from each other? You know, every place isn't the same just because it's the same country.
Exactly. It's so different. And what I love about all countries have this, and I've certainly spent so much time in Greece exploring those lesser known nooks and crannies of a beautiful country before we get to the islands, that in terms of the food, the same thing that has the same ingredients may have a little twist in one village. Or if you go up into a mountain village, it's different again. And that's maybe about recipes being passed down generations. That's a secret recipe that a chef would never share with me, bothering people as I do very often in kitchens. But it's that. And then there's the history, the different important ports from ancient Greek times, the amphitheatres, the temples to gods. There's a different story in a different part of Greece. And that means I've got plenty of inspiration to keep writing for a very long time, I hope.
Yeah, great. So tell us about the island of Agistri.
Oh, it is so beautiful. And it's quite unexpected. I didn't plan on setting a book there. I was going there because I'd never been. And I was on my way back to Hydra to do some writing and finish off The Island Love Song. And I had 4 days on Agistri just because it was sort of on the way. And I was just captivated by the charm, the simplicity of one of the island has a quieter port. Then there's the bigger port at the other end of the island. And in the middle, these incredible scented pine forests. And there were, for such a small island, there were so many different elements to it that I thought, I have to come back. I have to set a book here. And we'd rented an Airbnb, and the owner and her husband didn't speak any English, so we were relying on the international language of sign language and my poor Greek. But one night, they'd been fishing, and they gutted some fish in the tide line where our apartment was looking over. And there was a full moon rising, and they had a barbecue and invited us to join them. And the local priest walked along the seafront, and he stopped in for some fish and a glass of wine. And I thought, this is a book. This is a scene. It is, Geestry is burrowing under my skin and firing up my imagination. And all of those elements are somewhere, in some way, in Under the Lemon Tree.
Oh, lovely. I love that community feel and community spirit, and the fact that you see it firsthand. It's the kind of thing that you do read in a fiction novel or you see in a movie and you just think, oh, how lovely, how idyllic. So to be there and actually experience it is lovely.
It's magical. And those things that you do read about in fiction or see in the movies, sometimes we're all a bit cynical and go, oh, people don't live like that. Well, there are places that are that authentic and traditional, and that immense sense of community, and somewhere, usually at the heart of it, is a place of home-cooked food. So that is the way to everybody's hearts for sure, and it certainly is mine. And it's that route for me into that Greek culture to immerse yourself in authentic life, to bring it alive on a page, because I'm so mindful, Hannah, that it's not my culture. I'm not Greek. I have had Greek friends since I was a child, and I love it and respect it. So I have such a duty of care to be correct about the things I'm writing about, to be respectful as well. And hopefully the love I have for the country and culture does spring off the page.
Yeah, for sure. So tell us about some of your favourite Greek food.
Oh, my goodness. I actually haven't eaten yet, so this is going to make me ravenous, which I often am when I'm writing, because there's a lot of food in my books. And one of my favourite things, and it's so simple, it's called fava, which is a split yellow pea dip that is just boiled up with loads of garlic, loads of olive oil. And it's just one of those things that you can plunge in some pita breads to, or just eat with it scattered with capers. Or there's another roast aubergine dish called imambayeldi, which is roasted aubergine. You scoop the flesh out, you make a tomato cinnamon sauce, you restuff it and roast it again. Just so simple. And when, as you're lucky enough to live somewhere that the sun kisses the vegetables and makes them extra delicious, when you have an array of simple ingredients that are so fresh, so beautifully grown, there is nothing like a three-ingredient supper. And as for the sweet things that are always drenched in honey, and bakeries are my favourite places to visit in Greece, under the lemon tree, as the title suggests, there is a lemon tree on the island. And limonopita is the lemon cake that is mentioned in the book. And so many readers message me, email me saying, can you share a recipe for this dish you mentioned? Or where should I go to find out how to cook this? So I enlisted the help of one of the best Greek chefs in the world, Akis Petrezikis. He is renowned and revered in Greece. And so I cheekily emailed him and said, would you give me your recipe for limonopita to put at the end of the book so my readers can then cook it, experience it firsthand, and then, like we were saying, that power of community through food, passing the recipe on, and so it has a life off the page and beyond that. So I'm very excited to have that in this novel.
Yeah, how lovely, how special. So tell us about your characters, the main characters in Under the Lemon Tree.
So we have Kat, Katerina. She's a part Greek. She's born in the UK and her parents are Greek, and they have set up their life in London and they run a restaurant. And Kat has never felt particularly connected to her Greek roots, although there almost is no avoiding it with her parents, who drag her to Orthodox church at Easter. And, you know, they run a Greek restaurant. There's food and love at every turn. And she, when we meet her, is in the depths of a very dark time. Her twin brother has been killed in a car accident 6 months before, and she's reeling with coming to terms with her survivor's guilt, almost in a way, plus the fact that she has separated from her husband. She's doubting herself. She's second-guessing herself. And she's had to move back home with her parents, which for a grown-up is feeling like hell for her, because she has been smothered by food and love and told what to do, and there are various opinions. Now, she inherits quite unexpectedly a house on a geestery from her mother's brother that she didn't know about. Her mother has kept him a secret for reasons that are revealed in the novel. And Kat is a journalist by nature, and she, her profession is she's an interior design journalist. And she jumps at the opportunity, A, to escape her family, B, connect with her Greek heritage, and C, renovate a house. There is a sadness to it because it should have been her and her brother's, but now it's hers. And it's almost a journey of self-discovery, of renovation of a house, but renovation of herself. And what she's always longed to do is be a writer of fiction. And she begins to continue to write her magazine column, but with a twist, she starts to write about her grief and the metaphors that lend themselves to renovating a house, peeling back plaster and finding what's beneath the layers. And she comes into her own, and she also meets someone rather interesting that sparks an unexpected something of romance as well. So it's funny, it's sad, it's poignant, and there's food, of course, and there's Greece, of course, but it's very much a hopeful book and about the power of forgiveness and second chances and our chosen family, our village, our friends that rally around us through the great times and the hard. So it's, I hope, a very inspiring, fun story.
Oh, lovely. I love that when you can find a comparison or metaphors in something and find the meaning for something completely different. I can totally see the connections between renovating a house and grieving. That's really interesting.
Absolutely. And as she begins to write and find her own creative fictional voice within that, I really related to that because my writing journey started when I decided to write a novel. I used my experience of losing my mum very suddenly and fictionalized it. And it helped me, I suppose, make sense of my grief navigating it through writing fiction, which is exactly what Kat does in Under the Lemon Tree. There is such a catharsis to that, getting your thoughts out on paper. You know, all of us who have difficult times, a lot of advice is write a journal, write it down, or even say it out loud and ask for help or talk it through. There is a great power in the spoken and the written word rather than keeping things locked up inside. And so it was a real joy to take Kat on that journey. And you'll have to wait and see what happens when you read it.
Oh, lovely. Well, if people want to get a copy of Under the Lemon Tree, it's available now from our website, tre.radio, and it's by Emma Cowell, who we've been chatting with. Emma, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for all of your support, Hannah. It's been a treat to speak to you again.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Stephanie Nunes. She's a Brazilian writer who's been an avid reader for as long as she can remember. And with her passion for romance novels, she often created stories in her mind without ever putting them on paper. After moving to London with her husband, inspired by the city's atmosphere, she finally found the courage to fulfill her dream of writing. She's with us on the Book Show to talk about her novel Falling on a Duke. It's a swoon-worthy, time-travelling contemporary romance about a duke lost in time and a writer lost in heartbreak. Set in London, this contemporary rom-com follows 30-year-old writer Isabella. Struggling with heartbreak and writer's block, she accidentally runs over a man near Tower Bridge who claims to be a 19th century duke called Benjamin Waldorf. Welcome to the Book Show, Stephanie.
Thank you so much.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. And what a fabulous idea for a story. Where did this come from?
Well, I was We have a good group of friends in Brazil, of author friends, and we were like, we should do a series with a lot of stories with time travel. So each one of us chose a different kind of story to tell. I'm very fond of Dukes, so I also like a lot that romantic comedy from the 2000s, Katie and Leopold. So I thought it was a great idea just to bring a Duke from the past. And I wanted a protagonist who were a bit like me, like writing, living in London. She's a Brazilian as well. And I want a romantic comedy as something cute and funny. It has a little Korg who's also named Duke. So it kind of, it's really cute. And it was a really fun novel to write. I mean, I love romantic comedy. So I think they are my favorite genre.
Yeah, lovely. So tell us about the character of Isabella.
Isabella is a Brazilian. She lives in London. She's in her 30s. She's been through a lot of heartbreak recently. Her boyfriend broke off with her a few years ago. And she's been with a writer's block. So a writer with a writer's block is a big problem. And then she writes a historical novel. So when she bumps into this hot Duke, which is basically all the characters she writes, she gets really inspired, if you know what I mean.
So this Duke is from the 19th century, which is where time travel comes in.
Yeah, he's from the Regency period. I think the start, if I'm not mistaken, it's 1817. And he's a duke, which he wasn't supposed to be a duke. The title should have been to his brother, but his brother died, his father died, he has a sister. So he has a lot of problems. Then he just finds this cameo jewelry. And he wakes up in 2022. So he's kind of a bit confusing and he has to go home because his sister needs him. So Isabella is the one who's going to help him to find a way back home.
And I presume that as the reader, we really like the two of them and want them to be together. Is that the idea?
Yeah. Love wasn't supposed to get in the way, but it does. So they have to decide. I mean, he has to go back, but they fall in love. This love is real, but it's impossible. So there's kind of this a little drama in that. But I'm not going to tell what happens.
No. She runs him over near Tower Bridge. Tell us about that.
Yeah. I always she likes to ride in a scooter and she likes that region because it's all so old and vintage and she gets inspired by that. And she's just walking there. But here in England, I'm a Brazilian as well. So all the things go on the other side, right, from us in Brazil. So she looks one side that she's not used to that. And then a duke shows up and she really feels guilty about that. But I think Destiny knew what he was doing. So it's a very fun way to meet, a very meet cute situation.
Yeah. And there's a lovely bit in the book that coincides with you that happens with Isabella in the fact that she's a writer and she ends up writing Falling on a Duke, which is lovely.
Yes, exactly. It's I thought about if she's been through a writer's block, what should be the first story she will write after this difficult time? So Falling on a Duke seems the perfect one. And she gives it a happy ending. So it's kind of nice because later in the book, we find out that it's the first book that Isabella, because she also writes in Portuguese, that is her first language. But Falling on a Duke is the first story that she translates into English. And it's also my story that I translated into English and it wasn't planned. So that's really nice.
Oh, so did you originally write it in Portuguese?
Yes, it's published in Portuguese. It was published in January 2023. And when I think it was last year, I was thinking about, you know, I've been living here for 5 years now. And I thought about I should translate, you know, get the book in another language. And I don't know, it seems like the right choice to start with Falling on a Duke.
Yeah.
I think it was the right decision. I mean, it really warms my heart when I think about it.
Oh, that's lovely. And what about the way you wrote the book? How did you structure it? Did you have a clear idea of the ending when you first started? Did you plan a lot? How did you do it?
Yes, I am a plotter. I have to confess, I usually think about the story, and before I sit down to write it, I have to have all these chapters planned out. Sometimes it changes, but I have to know which way I'm going. And the end, it's usually, I mean, if I think about a plot, the end is usually what occurs me first. I know it's going to end that way. And then I just, my process kind of guide me through it. So I knew the way it was going to end since the beginning. Yes.
Yeah. And have you already started on another book?
I'm always writing. Yes. I don't know which one I'm going to launch in English next, but in Portuguese, I am a self-published writer, so I'm always writing something new. I have a launch there this week.
Oh, actually. Fantastic. And still on the subject of romantic comedy.
Yeah, I like a lot. This week's one, it's a romantic comedy. I write mostly in historical novels, something like Regency novels or Victorian period setting, but sometimes it has a little bit more drama, but usually I'm always going to the romantic comedy genre. It's my favorite one.
Yeah. Well, if people want to get a copy of Falling on a Duke, it's out now. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Stephanie Nunes, who we've been chatting with today. Stephanie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was lovely to be here.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Talk Radio Europe.
Your voice in Spain.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to the second part of tonight's book show. In the first hour, we were chatting with Ed Needham, Emma Cowell and Stephanie Nunes. In this hour, we're chatting to Jeffrey Deaver, the number one international best-selling author of more than 40 novels, three collections of short stories and a non-fiction law book. His first novel, featuring the character Lincoln Rhyme, The Bone Collector, was made into a major motion picture starring Denzel Washington and Angelina Jolie. In his latest novel, South of Nowhere, he returns to the unputdownable world of Colter Shaw. We're also chatting to C.R. Westbrook, who writes about showbiz, film and TV. Troublemaker is her debut novel, a dark comedy thriller about Elena, who has her dream job as a news reporter until a new rival shows up and a potential murder is uncovered. And we're chatting to Ben Markowitz, who grew up in Texas, London and Berlin. In 2013, Granta selected him as one of their best of young British novelists. His new novel, The Rest of Our Lives, is an unforgettable road trip of a novel about getting older and the challenges and rewards of long-term marriage. It asks the question, what's left when your kids grow up and leave home? Tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else, no one else can speak the words on your lips. Treat yourself in words unspoken, live your life with arms wide open.
Joining us us on the line now is Jeffrey Deaver, the number one international best-selling author of more than 40 novels, three collections of short stories, and a non-fiction law book. His books are sold in 150 countries and translated into 25 languages. His first novel, featuring Lincoln Rhyme, The Bone Collector, was made into a major motion picture starring Denzel Washington and Angelina Jolie. A former journalist, folk singer, and attorney, he was born outside of Chicago and has a Bachelor of Journalism degree from the University of Missouri and a law degree from Fordham University. He's back with us on the Book Show to talk about his latest novel, South of Nowhere. And in it, he returns to the unputdownable world of Colter Shaw. The clock is ticking and the survival window is rapidly closing. Welcome to the Book Show, Jeffrey.
Thank you, Hannah. Always good to talk to you.
Oh, it's lovely to have you back with us. I suppose you're always busy. I have that impression. Is that right?
Well, if I, of course, we're doing an audio now, but if we had video, I could lift the camera off and turn it around and point to the screen and show you that I'm taking a break to have a wonderful conversation with you. But the new Lincoln Rhyme book is well underway, and I have I still have about a month worth of work to do on that. And then I get back to the next Colter Shaw book. So in answer to your question, yep, always pretty busy. I kind of joke that after all those books you mentioned and the over 100 short stories, someday I'm going to get it right if I still keep at it.
Brilliant. And does it ever get confusing, you know, when you're writing multiple series at the same time? Do you have to sit down and think, hold on a minute, who am I writing about here?
Actually, that's a very good question. But no, because I work in different stages. And let me explain. I think we talked about this in the past, but I outline all of my books. I'm an inveterate outliner. I spend about 8 months planning the book ahead of time before I write a single word of the prose. And when that's done, I put the outline in front of me, about 100-page outline or so, and then I generate the text. Well, I can generate the text of one book after the outline's done and work on the outline for another book at the same time, but they don't really meet. In other words, I can't generate text for two books, nor can I outline two books at the same time. So I've got a system down pretty well.
Yeah, amazing. And when you look back at The Bone Collector, does it seem like a lifetime ago? I mean, can you remember when that first book came out?
I can, yes, and it was a lifetime ago. It was 20 some odd years, and of course, that was not my first book. It was about my seventh or eighth book. I had written a number of books under my name and then under some pseudonyms. They were more in the mystery vein. Now, for your listeners, they might be interested to know that I at least define crime fiction in two different ways. One, the murder mystery. That's a classic Dorothy L. Sayers, Agatha Christie, Hercule Poirot kind of book, Miss Marple. That's where the detective discovers what happened in the past, who the bad guy is, who done it. Mm-hmm. I tend to write thrillers, and that is a book that looks at the question, what is going to happen? You know, the serial killer, will he or she strike again? Will the terrorist attack? And I began with the murder mysteries, and some were nominated for awards. They did well, but they didn't do quite as well as I had hoped. And then I decided to start writing the kind of book that I enjoyed reading, and that's the thriller. And that is a book that takes place, I mean, a typical Deaver book takes place over, say, 2 days tops. There's deadline after deadline, and then big surprise ending, followed by big surprise ending, followed by, yes, you guessed it, another big surprise ending. And those are the books that took off. And The Bone Collector was really, I can't say it was the first in that category of mine, but it was certainly the most most influential and the biggest of the books when I changed my direction.
Yeah. And when you created that character of Lincoln Rhyme, did you think at the time that there's going to be more books about him? I mean, how much do you plan further books and series in advance?
Well, I generally write series because I, growing up, loved characters. I loved, of course, George Smiley, John le Carré's wonderful character, sort of the antithesis of James Bond. But I love James Bond, too, all of those books. And I know readers enjoy spending time with the characters they like, but I thought Lincoln Rhyme was a bit improbable. He, for your listeners who don't know, he's a quadriplegic, someone paralyzed from the neck down in an accident on a crime scene where he was a crime scene searcher, a forensic guy, a forensic cop. Brilliant. Sherlock Holmes was an inspiration. Now, the books are set in the present day, but I loved Holmes's brilliant ability to use his mind as his weapon. I think in one or two of the Conan Doyle short stories, Holmes had a gun. An old Webley, if I recall correctly. But he didn't really rely on fisticuffs or guns. He used his mind. Well, that's what I wanted Lincoln Rhyme to be. But he's still, as I say, a bit improbable because he can't get out into the field quite so much. But then the character appeared and his popularity soared. And I'm no dummy. I have many, many people who rely on me. For instance, MasterCard, Visa, American Express, the people who work for the bank that holds my mortgage on my house. So, of course, I had to keep writing the Lincoln Rhyme books. And, of course, I joke, but my job is to keep readers happy. That's the only thing I exist for. And so Lincoln Rhyme and now Colter Shaw has become, equally popular.
Yeah. So how many books have there been now about Colter Shaw?
South of Nowhere is the fifth book, and they began because I alternate, I guess we could say, about 7 years ago. In other words, I alternate Lincoln Rhyme and Colter Shaw. But maybe 2 years ago, CBS Television in America created a show called Tracker that is available in the UK and actually around the world now on Paramount Plus and Disney Plus. I can never know what company owns another company, but those are the platforms. If you're in America, you can see it on CBS, or you can stream it. You can watch it on Hulu. I don't know. You can call me up and come, bring the popcorn, come over. You can watch it with me as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, the show Tracker, number one show in America, number one network show in America. And I think the number two we just got the figures. I think it's the number three show in all of the United States. And that, by that, I mean, including the streaming platforms, third after the Squid Game, of all things, a very bizarre film about people dying. I'm not a huge fan, but it's quite popular, apparently. The second show is, at least when these figures came out, was Adolescence, an absolutely riveting, brilliant show. Very, very challenging to watch, but an important show. I think everyone should see it.
Mm. So Tracker is based on your 2019 novel, Never Game.
Technically. And you heard my hesitation there. Now, I know Justin Hartley, the star of the show, Ken Olin, the producer, director, and the creator of the TV show, Roxy Olin, his daughter. And we met years ago. Well, now it was kind of during the COVID era to try to put together the show. And we all knew it wasn't going to be the Never Game. Technically, it was going to be Colter Shaw, because the Never Game is a great book. It's about a murder in Silicon Valley. Not that we haven't heard about Silicon Valley lately, is that right? Oh my goodness. Well, the premise was kind of interesting, that a person, I'm not going to give away, a young man, old man, younger woman, older woman, who knows, bases a series of crimes on video games for reasons that are ultimately revealed in the book. And I thought that was a very clever premise, and the book did very well. And but Ken said, well, you know, it's kind of a limited premise. We like the idea that Colter Shaw travels around the country in his camper. I think they're called campers, if I'm a caravan or camper, I'm not mistaken, in the UK. And he comes to a new town. There's a crime. He's looking for a reward that's been offered by maybe the parents of a missing child. or a escaped by the police for an escaped convict or a murder suspect they can't find. And he, of course, gets embroiled in not only the crime, but as I like to do in all of my books, what I call the soap opera element. You know, the EastEnders, the Coronation Street, and America, it would be As the World Turns, The Guiding Light. And I say that with affection because the personal component of stories is vital. And even in crime, that is expected as a multiple dimension of the main characters. In other words, the police chief detective inspector, she may have problems at home. She may have issues with her son or daughter. And that's as integral a part of the conflict as solving the crime.
Yeah, absolutely. And for people who haven't read any Colter Shaw books yet, tell us or tell them about the character. What is he like? What does he do?
Sure. Colter Shaw is a loner. He's you can kind of think of the of course, they're set in the modern day, of course, but they're like the man with no name, the Clint Eastwood character from the Western. And he is really an archetypal Western hero. He travels around the country, as I say, not on horseback, but on a Yamaha motorcycle and with this caravan. And he travels to find the rewards. He is taciturn, the strong, silent type, doesn't put up with any nonsense. Sometimes he pursues the role of the bringer of justice if the police are not able to do that themselves. The books are not violent, but they are all typical of a Deaver book. Colter gets himself into a number of scrapes every few chapters, or the characters that he interacts with get themselves into scrapes, and he has to save them. One of the more interesting aspects of the Colter Shaw series, though, is that his father, and he's one of three siblings, was a brilliant professor at an unnamed university on the West Coast of America. You can think the University of California, although I don't name it. Mm-hmm. But he had to flee from the San Francisco area because he had made some discoveries about, I guess I could call it, this is not giving anything away really, corporate shenanigans about the infusion of corporations into government. Now, I have to say, everyone, I was there first. We now hear about what's going on in America now, and certain corporations and certain corporate CEOs who are very active in American politics. Well, the Never Game was there first. Now that I say that, I hope I didn't give anyone any ideas. But anyway, we'll hope for the best. But I say it doesn't. That template does not come across well in my book. In other words, these are the bad guys, bad corporate executives trying to work their way into government. And so anyway, Colter's father realized that, and he was threatened. He took the Camry to an enclave in the Sierra Nevada mountains, about 200 miles from San Francisco, and taught them survival skills. So Colter is a survivalist. He climbs mountains. He knows how to escape from avalanches. And in the latest book, if any of your listeners out there want to pick up South of Nowhere, and they find themselves in a situation where they may be confronted with a bomb. You know, we call them in the crime world IEDs, improvised explosive devices. All they need to save themselves is a handful of honeybees. And Hannah, if that did not just sell the book, I don't know what will.
I wasn't expecting you to say a handful of honeybees, I'll be honest with you. So where does that come into it? Or is that giving too much away?
I can't give anything away, but it is typical. However, I joke, of course, but it's typical of my planning. As I mentioned earlier, I do the outlining, but I also do research because, you know, readers love these little esoteric facts, such as the honeybees, how to survive an avalanche. I think, you know, not a problem many of us will be in, but hey, if you are and you read one of my books, or at least I think it was The Final Twist a few books ago, that will teach you how to survive an avalanche. In South of Nowhere, if you ever find yourself trapped in a submerged automobile or SUV, you may find some tricks there. But believe me, these are not textbooks. They're called generally, South of Nowhere, I think, has been called by a number of reviewers a one sitting read, which is a huge compliment to me because, I want people to race forward. The great American pulp fiction writer, he wrote detective fiction in the 1960s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, Mickey Spillane, he said, people don't read books to get to the middle. We read books to get to the end. And it's our job as writers to make sure people do that. I mean, there's nothing worse than starting a book that seems to have some promise and then getting a third or halfway through. And you think, you know, I'd rather go mow the lawn or change the oil in my car than do this, than finish this book.
Oh, yeah, definitely shouldn't be like that, should it? It shouldn't be hard work. It should be fun. You should want to cancel having to mow the lawn in order to finish reading the book.
Well said. Well said, Hannah.
Well, if people want to get a copy of South of Nowhere, it's out now. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Jeffrey Deaver, who we've been chatting with today. Jeffrey, thanks so much for joining us. Lovely to chat with you again.
Anna, absolutely love our conversations. You take care now.
Hello, little Alan Bennett here. If I'm not writing books, then the thing I like most is listening to the book club on Talk Radio Europe. Fancy.
Joining us on the line now is C.R. Westbrook. She's a writer who writes about showbiz, film and TV. Troublemaker is her first fiction novel, coming 25 years after her first literary endeavour, writing biographies of Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio. The book is a dark comedy thriller about Eleanor, who has her dream job as a news reporter until a new rival shows up and a potential murder is uncovered. Welcome to the book show, Caroline.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for joining us. So congratulations on your debut novel. How exciting.
Yes, incredibly exciting. It's been really good fun so far.
Oh, so how does it compare to writing biographies?
Well, that was a very long time ago. That was 30 years or so. So I can't even remember what that was like. Those obviously were very, very different propositions because I was doing these kind of fairly short, unauthorized, as it were, kind of roundups of careers of Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio, which were translated into several languages. So I was quite, sort of pleasantly surprised to find the Portuguese edition a couple of years after it was published, and I think German as well, and Japanese and various others. But obviously, this is a whole other war game because this was a much longer process because, you know, there was the whole process of writing, submitting, finding a publisher, the editing process, more editing, everything else that goes with actually putting out a fiction book, which is it's fairly incomparable to, you know, writing 10,000 words on a film star and just chucking that out with, you know, nice pictures in the book and on the cover and everything else. So, yeah, a very different experience, and certainly from the fact that was 30 years ago as well. So the whole process of marketing and everything else completely changed with the advent of social media and the popularity of the internet. But, you know, it's all been overwhelmingly positive, which has been fantastic.
Yeah, that's great. And was it kind of obvious to you that you wanted to write about a journalist and a news reporter kind of sticking to a world that you know?
I mean, they do say write what you know. And obviously there are certain things in this book that are inspired by real life. I don't know if I should go into detail about what actually happened and what didn't. I can, however, confirm I, unlike whoever it was in the book, because I'm not going to spoil that for anybody, I can confirm I've never pushed anybody out of a four-story window.
That's good.
Yeah. So that bit's definitely fiction. But, you know, a lot of the stuff which goes on is maybe inspired by things that have happened to me, given like a more of like a fictional slant, because obviously I work at Metro now on the Metro website, but I have worked in the past for various other publications, including Empire Magazine and BBC and, you know, quite a few other places. And you do kind of you know, pick up a lot of experiences, especially when you're hanging around interviewing film stars and reality TV stars and that kind of thing. So, you know, there's a lot there, from like interviews going wrong to terrible showbiz parties, right down to what part of my aim of the book was, which was to actually focus on the day-to-day kind of office politics and goings on of an office. Because everybody thinks this is a really, you know, it's a glamorous job. You get to do red carpets, you get to meet film stars, you get to meet TV stars. And that's kind of like a very small percentage of it, because actually on a day-to-day basis, it's very much like working in any office. You know, you have the office politics, you have the gossip, you have the fights over who gets to take their leave in the first 2 weeks of August. You know, you have the people who put fish in the office microwave, which we don't really want to talk about. You know, so you have all that going on. And of course, as happens in the last quarter of the book, you have your interesting company corporate events. And of course, the last part of this book takes place at one of those. And that too was kind of inspired by one that I used to go to in one of my former jobs. So, you know, there's a lot going on there that's beyond the usual. You know, I've read a lot of books of, like, star reporter meets film star on red carpet, swept off, her feet falls in love, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do something a bit more in line with the kind of the books that I enjoy reading, which is, by and large, kind of psychological thrillers. And, you know, secondly, I just wanted to make it more about the people in the office rather than kind of, you know, I don't personally know anybody who's been swept off their feet by an A-list star on a red carpet.
No.
So I just wanted to make it a bit more relatable, if you get my drift.
Yeah, definitely. A bit more realistic.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I love that you commented, you said terrible showbiz parties at one point. Again, I think people on the outside would automatically assume that a showbiz party is going to be glitz and glamour and really fun and exciting. Can you tell us about one that wasn't then?
Well, not always. I mean, you know, there was a party that's based on one that I went to many, many years ago. And, you know, the thing about those, I would say, you know, if you have any level of social anxiety, going to, you know, a showbiz party is going to be just the same as, like, going to your mate's party. You know, if you go alone, there's a strong possibility you're going to leave alone. There's a strong possibility you might spend an awful lot of it standing in the corner by yourself. It's much like going to any party, really. And look, I'm not going to lie. I've been to some brilliant ones, okay? I've also been to some that, you know, maybe haven't been in particularly nice venues, or you haven't necessarily seen anyone famous because they've been shipped off to a VIP enclosure. Or, you know, you might have gone to one that, you know, it ends quickly or, you know, doesn't live up to expectations, or the venue is horrible. You know, you get invited to, as a journalist, you get invited to a lot of these things. And, you know, even now I still occasionally go to things, and sometimes they're great and sometimes they're not. And it's pretty much like going to any other, you know, any kind of social event that you might go to. You know, there's sometimes they're great, sometimes they're, you know, a load of rubbish and you leave really early. And I don't necessarily think just because, you know, you've got the addition of famous people that it's necessarily going to be as glamorous as you think.
No.
And again, some of them are, and some of them, you know, some of them are just a bit of a disaster, really. And I think in Troublemaker, we focus on one of the ones that's a disaster.
Yes.
Just to kind of, you know, because that's more fun, really.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not trying to dish the dirt at all. So can you tell us a positive story of either meeting or interviewing a celeb or going to an exciting, fun party?
Oh, there's been things that I've done before. Most of the people, I don't really do interviews anymore. The job I'm doing now is a bit more kind of office focused, and, you know, is a bit more kind of related to editing and that kind of thing. So I don't really get a chance to interview anymore. But, you know, I've most of the ones I've done have actually been pretty much okay, because, you know, I always have this theory that if you're interviewing somebody for something that they are promoting, much as I'm doing now, that is part and parcel of the job. And at the very least, you know, I really hope when I'm doing that somebody will at the very least be polite and civil to me. And for the most part, that is the case.
Mm.
You know, maybe people wouldn't always necessarily be the most interesting people you might want to talk to or meet. But, you know, as long as they're pleasant, I'm completely fine with that. But, you know, there have been occasions where things have gone wrong. If someone has not liked a question, or somebody has given one-word answers. I've had occasions where somebody has not been well and has wanted to end the interview straight away. You know, I've had occasions where somebody is like an up-and-coming person or is not particularly famous because maybe they're a contestant on a reality show and they haven't really had anything to say to you, and then you have to work really, really hard to actually get an interesting line out of them. And, you know, also, you don't want to be that person that maybe is getting the same sound bites as everybody else. So, you know, there's an awful lot of variables when it comes to interviewing. And, you know, it's a bit of a skill. Do I miss it? I don't know if I do. You know, there's something exciting. When you actually get to meet somebody that you really admire, that is fantastic, obviously. But when but a lot of the time, it's kind of like it's part of the job, really. And again, it's not always glamorous because you've then got to go back to the office and write it up. And if somebody hasn't been that forthcoming, it's not always the easiest job in the world. And I think, you know, that's kind of the downside of potentially like having this opportunity to, you know, spend a bit of time with somebody who's like really, really well known.
Yeah.
And yeah, like I said, sometimes it's fantastic. And sometimes, you know, you think, oh my God, I'm so kind of privileged to have the chance to spend a few minutes with somebody who other people would probably like, you know, kill to spend a few minutes with on a red carpet. So, you know, there was fun stuff. I mean, you know, there's I've done some fun red carpets. There's certain awards ceremonies. Awards ceremonies are always really good to do, for example, because everybody's really in the mood to talk to you. Everybody's kind of excited. I've done Eurovision a few times, which, you know, is kind of topical because obviously that's, you know, happening at the moment. And, you know, that's kind of a personal, like, favourite interest of mine. So to do that, to actually go and cover that was a little bit of a dream come true. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's been some good stuff. But then obviously in my Empire days, occasionally you'd get to jet off somewhere and interview someone. That would be fun too.
Oh, absolutely. So tell us about the characters in Troublemaker.
Okay, so Elena she's your lead character. She's the lead character. She is, you know, I kind of described her as like the grown-up version of Cher from Clueless. You know, she's quite sort of self-centered. She's kind of nice and funny and intelligent and a little bit self-centered and quite obsessed with her clothes. And, you know, likes nice things, has a rich boyfriend. Should she necessarily be with him? Well, you know, you'll have to read that and find out. And she's about to get promoted to, she thinks she's about to get a promotion at work at this showbiz website she works for. And then this new girl comes along called Katya, who comes out of nowhere and gets the job. And, you know, Elena's kind of a bit thrown by this, but then all this kind of odd stuff starts happening to kind of wreck her personal life, her professional life. Everything is going wrong for her, which was not going wrong before. And she starts to wonder if her murky past, let's say this casually, she might have murdered a colleague like 7 years ago in her previous job.
love that you say that casually.
Yeah. She's funny, she's popular, she's spicy, and yeah, she might have murdered someone, but, you know.
As you do.
It happens. And she starts to wonder if this is back to haunt her, if it's got anything to do with it. And we get a dual timeline where she is at this old other website called Gleam. She's now working for a website called Spark. And she was working for this other website, and she had this massive love-hate relationship with a girl called Laura, who is our victim. And you sort of find out from your timeline what actually happens to her. So when all this bad stuff starts happening, she's nobody actually believes her. Nobody believes, because they all think Katya is amazing. And the only people that believe her are Lindsay, who is her best friend, who's like a bit of a like mad sort of like party girl, and Nathan, who is her colleague, who she's got a bit of a crush on. She's got a secret crush on, has for ages, and he sort of believes her, and things progress from there, because like I said, she may not be 100% happy with her boyfriend, so you can tell what happens there. So it's a case of, you know, is she being targeted? What's going on? And can she figure out what's happening before, you know, her obit is the next big headline?
Wow.
So, yeah, it's kind of like, you know, I read a lot of psychological thrillers. I wanted to write one, and, you know, reading like a thriller a week is kind of what kept me going during lockdown. And, you know, when I first sat down to start trying to write something at the start of 2021, I was working on something different at the time, which hopefully is, you know, which I'm now kind of rewriting at the moment. I wrote about one chapter before realizing I couldn't do it straight, that like humor was coming out and I had to kind of be funny with it. And I just thought, you know, psychological thrillers obviously deal with a lot of very sensitive issues and they're not in themselves a subject for comedy. But I thought, is there a way I can do this that actually it is funny and, you know, you have got one-liners and you have got witty characters and you know, humorous situations, then and then still kind of keep the serious essence of the book. And, I'm hoping that's something I've kind of done with Troublemaker by keeping the humour quite dark, because obviously it's you know, there's the odd moments of, like, knockabout comedy, but generally it's quite dark, twisted humour. At the core of it, it does have a serious theme or serious themes. And, you know, I'm interested very much in how we treat each other, because I'm going to be honest, it's not always as we should.
Mm.
Yeah, we're all guilty of it. We've all been horrible to somebody needlessly when we could have actually chosen something different. It depends. It could be anything. You know, it could be something as simple as shouting at the bus driver who didn't stop for you because you're having a bad day.
Yeah.
I hold my hands up and admit I've done that. You know, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done it. But, you know, we've all done it. And, you know, we never know what sort of day someone's having. So we probably shouldn't have done. And I'm interested in that. And I'm also interested in whether or not we can make that huge mistake and still get a second chance and still be redeemable. And you know, these are kind of issues that I've kind of tackled that may be a little bit more serious within kind of the context of the book. And hopefully, you know, hopefully kind of done them justice.
Yeah, great stuff. So have you already started about the second novel?
I'm writing something at the moment, which is kind of a rewrite of what I was writing before. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens with that. It's quite a different theme, the second one. I can't really say too much at the moment. Again, it's the same sort of dark comedy thriller type of thing, but it's not set in the same world, shall we say. Because I don't want to just write endless kind of reworks of Troublemaker. And I think, you know, there's a lot of other interesting things out there. There's a lot of things that personally happened to me in my life that I think kind of are interesting to spin out into books. And I think writers do draw a lot of personal experience.
Mm.
So, you know, let's wait and see what happens on that front.
Yeah. Great. Well, in the meantime, if listeners want to get a copy of Troublemaker, it's available now on our website, tre.radio, and it's by C.R. Westbrook, who we've been chatting with today. Caroline, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Love to talk to you.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Ben Markowitz, who grew up in Texas, London and Berlin. His novels include Either Side of Winter, You Don't Have to Live Like This, and most recently, The Sidekick. In 2013, Granta selected him as one of their best of young British novelists, and in 2015, he won the James Tate Black Memorial Prize. He lives in London and teaches creative writing at Royal Holloway, University of London. He's with us on the Book Show to talk about his latest novel, The Rest of Our Lives. It's an unforgettable road trip of a novel about getting older and the challenges and rewards of long-term marriage. It also asks what's left when your kids grow up and leave home. Welcome to the Book Show, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for joining us. So this feels like a bit of a personal novel. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think all the books are personal. You know, if you're going to write a novel, you're probably going to spend 2 or 3 years with a set of characters, their situations, and some of the thoughts you have about them. And if you're going to spend 2 or 3 years, you probably want to make it about stuff that matters to you. So I guess they're all personal. I mean, there's a more personal element to this in that the main character turns out to have the same kind of cancer that I had when I was finishing the book. I don't know if that's what you mean by the question.
Yeah, there's a lot of you and things that you kind of went through in this book.
Yeah, I mean, I want to say at the beginning that my hero's marriage is very different from my marriage, but in other ways we have some similarities. He's a law professor. I'm the child of law professors. And when I started the novel, I was starting to experience some symptoms that couldn't be diagnosed. I kept going to my GP and he didn't know what they were. And I gave those symptoms to the character, not knowing where it would lead. And by the time I finished the book, I was going through chemo. And by that point, I knew what I had. And by the end of the novel, the character knows what he has too.
Mm, interesting. So tell us about the character of Tom in the book.
Yeah, so he's in his 50s. And it begins with a kind of monologue in which he says that when his kids were small, his wife had an affair. And they decide to stick out the marriage until the kids leave home. It's a kind of private deal with himself that he makes. What matters to them is the family. But once the youngest child leaves for university, then they can rethink their lives from scratch. And the book more or less begins when he drops off the youngest child at university.
Hmm. Interesting. And where did you get that idea from? It's a good one.
The truth is, I was sitting around and a few years ago, and that opening line came into my head, and I sat down and started writing. And I wrote the first couple pages of the book and then put them away. I was working on something else at the time. I mean, obviously, I've got two kids. My narrator has two kids. My daughter's about to go to university next year. And I've spent the last 18 years of my life being trained by my children into being a parent. And in a few years' time, it's not that training becomes irrelevant, but you have to rethink how you're going to live your life because you're not looking after dependents anymore, at least not dependent kids. And so that seemed like a rich subject, partly because I like writing about family, and this seems like the next stage of family to write about.
Yeah. And a subject that a lot of people will relate to, of course.
Yeah. It's something that happens, it happens to everybody.
Yeah.
I don't know how you feel about this, but you spend the first, whatever it is, I don't know how you want to measure it, but you spend the first 18 years of your life living inside a family until you leave for university. And then you tend to have a period, a kind of interregnum period, where you're not in a family. You may be living with friends or on your own. Maybe you're dating, making money for the first time, and you have this independent life outside of a family. And then if you do get married and have kids, you live the next stage of your life inside a family again. And they seem like very different ways to live to me, inside a family and outside of family. And this book is partly about the attempt to think about the transition.
Mm. Oh, very much so. I find it fascinating how looking at our lives and how they form different chapters depending on who you're with and whether your parents are alive, whether you have children, all that kind of stuff. They're completely different sections of our lives. And we're with people in later life who perhaps may not have known our parents before. I find that really, really fascinating. I talk about that with my husband a lot.
Yeah. And there's this idea that what we want, I don't know if it's an idea. I don't know what your opinion about this is, but it's often sold to us is that what we want from life is the independence of our 20s. And there are problems with family life, but there are a lot of comforts to it. And the prospect of living outside of a nuclear family is very scary for a lot of us. I mean, I can't say that I much liked it when I had to get shipped off to university and I suddenly found myself in a world entirely made up of 18-year-olds. That seemed like a scary kind of world. What did you feel when you went to uni? Did you feel like it was a sudden release from family life, or did you feel like it was a kind of...
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I didn't actually go to university. I went to college, but still lived at home when I did that. But then I went traveling and lived abroad and did that pretty much from the age of 18, 19, and always had a loving family to come home to, but loved the independence and excitement of traveling around the world and the idea that you could live wherever you wanted to and find a job and be self-sufficient. That was really exciting to me.
You sound more adventurous than I would.
Well, I've been living in Spain for over 20 years, so it never really stopped.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I've been living in England and I'm an American.
Yeah.
And you get these sort of free adventure points as an expat, right?
Whatever
you haven't accomplished in your life, at least you've moved somewhere else.
Definitely. It's a badge of honor, I feel.
Yeah. But not easy either. Not easy.
No, absolutely. Well, I always think when people who are living in their home country look at you as an expat and say, oh, you're so lucky. I you know, it annoys me slightly. I think, well, no, it's not luck. It was a choice. You can live abroad too if you want to.
Yeah. And it's a lot of hard work, right? A lot of hard work trying to explain yourself to people who maybe don't share the same cultural references.
Yeah, for sure. So can you tell us about Tom's wife in the book?
Yeah, I mean, so I feel like the glib way I sometimes describe this book is as being about a guy who walks out on his marriage, makes the marriage seem more loveless than it really was. Tom's wife grew up posher than he did. But that makes it, even putting it like that, makes it sound like she's a kind of satirical figure. And I don't think of her that way. You know, she grew up upper middle class, the kind of family that had a second home in Cape Cod. But she also grew up with a lot of taste and style. She's very good at making occasions. It's the kind of second home which isn't glitzy or fancy or even that comfortable. But you walk in and you feel like this is the house of somebody who's of a family who's really thought about how they want to live. And then she enters an adult life in which her sense of herself can't really be satisfied by the way her life has turned out. So she thinks of herself as somebody who is useful to people. She wants to be useful to people. And for a while, she's a teacher, but then various things go wrong. And when she has kids, she gives that up to look after the kids. But then her affection is a little bit too intense for them. And they also get older and stop needing you in the same way. And she's never quite had a career to replace the teaching that she'd given up on. And that gives her with a lot of nervous psychic energy that she doesn't know what to do with. And part of the battle in their marriage is that she's a worrier and Tom refuses to be.
Mm. I feel like even though this is a fictional story, I feel like when people read it, it might affect them. It might get them really thinking about their own lives and their own family dynamic and their own marriage, perhaps. Were you conscious of that? Did you want people to do that? Or
yeah, I mean, I always hope that that's the, you know, one of the things I say to students sometimes is that if you have a lot of big things happen in your books, there's a danger that events can turn into a kind of monopoly money.
Mm.
You don't really care how much you're spending because it's not real. And as much as possible in my novels, I want the events in them, the things that happen, to seem like real money. And that sometimes means that they're much less dramatic than they could be. You know, this is a story about a guy who drops his youngest child off at university. But the hope is that if you make the reader feel that real money is being used, that even very small events can turn out to be enormously significant.
Mm. Yeah, well, it's about real people, isn't it? And real issues and real emotions. So I think a lot of people will either relate to the people or the scenarios that are happening in the book, or maybe they start thinking about their lives in a way they hadn't done before.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I that's part of the reason I write books, to imagine how I want to live my life, what kind of life I should be living.
So do you ask yourselves those questions then, even though you're writing about fictional? And I know this book isn't about your marriage or your situation or anything like that, but when you're writing about people making big decisions, does in the way that you'd hope readers start thinking about things, does it make you start thinking about things?
Yeah, maybe I start thinking about things before I write about them. But yeah, that's mm-hmm. that's the idea. I mean, I feel like I'm drawn to seeker types, not just in fiction, but in life. People who think, why am I living the way I do? How could I be living differently? What would the consequences be if I made some changes? And, you know, it's very easy to slip into patterns of life that you didn't choose, that were chosen for you. And one of the things that sometimes sets off a novel, it can be kind of the launching pad for it, is to give a character a moment when they suddenly forced with a need to make a choice when they hadn't been making choices before. And I think one of those moments is when your youngest goes off to university, when your kids leave home. Then you're suddenly confronted with what it means to have a marriage in a way that you haven't been before.
Definitely. Life is full of choices, isn't it? And so many decisions that we make can, well, impact us hugely.
That's the hope, right? I mean, I guess it's the danger as well, but you want to feel that the choices you make can reshape how you live.
Mm. Yes, I think it's a sad and scary place to be when you feel like you don't have a choice. You know, when you said choices are made for you, sometimes that can be a very, very negative, dark place to be, depending on the situation. You know, if you feel like life is just happening to you as opposed to you, yeah, making those choices and decisions of what you want to happen in your life.
Yeah, and I think actually that's a good description of what Amy, the wife, is going through at the beginning of the book. She has this sense that Tom, her husband, is about to walk out on her because of what happened, you know, 12 years before. And she feels helpless in the face of it. And she also feels like she can't even talk about it, because to talk about it means bringing up what she had done when the kids were small. And part of the complication of that is that their older child, their son, was old enough to know what was going on, but it's not clear what their daughter, who was 6 at the time, knew about it. And so Amy can't even talk with her daughter, who's about to go off to university, about the fear that she has that Tom is about to walk out on her. And she feels trapped in it. But there's a kind of opposite worry, I think, that Tom is going through. And maybe in some ways, this is the core of the book. So one of the things that Tom is wrestling with is the fact that his own dad walked out on him when he was about 13 or 14 years old and started a second family with a new woman. And he loved his father and was close to him. And he was kind of conscious of what was happening when his parents' marriage broke down. But he was sympathetic enough to the dad that he couldn't just turn against him for what he had done. And at a certain point in this novel, Tom feels a possibility of starting up again with an old college girlfriend. And he gets this feeling of terror connected to his dad that you can do almost anything to yourself. You can actually do almost anything to yourself, remake your life in almost any way. And you might not even be unhappy. In a way, that's the fear, that you might not even be unhappy, even if you completely change the things that you used to care about to get there.
Mm.
And that sense of how really adaptable people are is not just a source of hope, but a source of horror. This thought that you can do almost anything to yourself and still get by.
Yeah. Or that anything can be done to you. You know, yeah. It's amazing how resilient we are as humans. Everybody goes through tough times, whether it's to do with health or loss or money or whatever. And yeah, we all have to deal with it and cope with it. And, you know, you always meet people that make you think, gosh, I can't believe they've been through that and come out the other side of that. And you meet other people who spend their whole lives being victims, feeling like people are constantly against them and life is constantly against them. And it's fascinating how people deal with trauma or bad things happening to them.
Yeah. And you wonder where that comes from, that way of dealing with the events of your life.
Yeah.
Is it something you're born with? Is it something that you get taught in early childhood? I don't know.
Mixture of all of the above, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fascinating. So now the book is out there, do you need a bit of a rest, you know, from writing and from all the characters before you start up a new novel?
It's a good question. I mean, at the moment, I've been working on some journalism. It's partly connected to the book. You know, you try to write some pieces about things that are related to it. And it's the end of my teaching term, so I'm about to be hit with a ton of marking. So I don't need excuses not to write, because I've been given plenty of them. But no, I like writing. I like sitting down for a few hours a day and trying to think about things. So I look forward to getting back to it when I can.
Yeah. Well, in the meantime, if listeners want to get a copy of The Rest of Our Lives, it's out now. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Ben Markowitz, who we've been chatting with today. Ben, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for talking to me.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by audible.co.uk. Download one title each month, plus unlimited listening to thousands of Audible originals, podcasts, and audiobooks. Just click on the Audible banner at www.tre.radio.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels, and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.